Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Since the start of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, the West has talked at Russia and Russians. Russia's side of the story is essentially absent, and intentionally so. On this edition of the program, we talk with two preeminent Russian scholars about their own country and Ukraine. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Dmitry Suslov. He's the Deputy Director of the Center for Comprehensive European International Studies at the Higher School of Economics. And we also have Maxim Suchkov. He is the Director of the Center for Advanced American Studies at Moscow State Institute of International Relations. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Maxim. You know, Maxim, the last few weeks have been tumultuous in so many different ways. And I was educated as an academic historian of modern European history. And I used to teach how the Versailles system failed and gave us the Second World War. And now I look at the system that was made primarily, exclusively actually, by the West, in the post-Cold War order. That order has failed. And institutionally, it's failed. Ideologically, it's failed. And so where do we go from here? Because institutions, at least the way I look at it, vis-a-vis Russia, are in tatters. Go ahead, Maxim.
Well, remember in late 1980s and early 1990s, Francis Fukuyama wrote his famous The End of History essay. And I think what we're observing now is yet another end of the end of history, in the sense that, back in the day, the argument was that, the world kind of found its ideal framework for development, neoliberal democracy, market economy. What struck me over the past week, and that brought me to think that we're now seeing the end of history, that the three countries the United States turned to seek to undermine Russian kind of grip on energy markets and on the world were Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. I think they're all great partners of the Russian Federation, but for years the United States have sanctioned them and blamed the Saudis in particular for human rights violations and all kind of stuff. But right now it appears that, the bad is called good when the worst happens, according to the U.S. logic. But I think it sends the signal to the rest of the world that there is no such thing as quote-unquote value-based foreign policy. And what we're seeing is interest-based foreign policy, and it will be, in this particular conflict, will be settled on interest-based solutions, either through war or through balance of interests.
Dmitry, so, one of the things I find very interesting is that when you look at the Cold War and in the post-Cold War order that ended, in my opinion, on February 24th, it is a system that that had a hegemon that basically called the terms and conditions of engagement. But now we're really back to great power politics, the way it has always been in history. I think that it was the Cold War and the post-Cold War order. They were anomalies in history. And I think that, a citizenry doesn't understand that. Most of academia is politically driven, but we're back at great power politics. Go ahead.
Well, I think that we're witnessing a pivotal moment in international relations, and certainly the period which began with the fall of Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union is now over. That was a pretty abnormal period in the history of international relations when the United States, with the help of certain allies, tried to universalize certain value systems, certain series of institutions, and establish basically a hegemonic system worldwide. Now it's over, and it's clear. The American foreign policy is changing really drastically, and I also witnessed the end, or at least a pause, a significant pause in the value-based policy of the United States. This is a certain continuation of the trend which began with Donald Trump and then continued with Joe Biden when the United States ended to expand the system of U.S.-led institutions and U.S.-led alliances, when they actually canceled the policy of forceful regime change in the other countries. I also see certain limits to the U.S. power, to the U.S. ability to lead and to act as a benevolent hegemon. Because benevolent hegemons, they produce global public goods and they offer something good, something positive to the countries that they would want to engage in their system. What does the United States offer now to countries that the that Washington wants to support the U.S. attempts to contain Russia? What does the United States offer to countries like China, India, Brazil, except for threats, except for blackmail, and the threats of new sanctions? Nothing. It means that, you know, the United States, of course, remains a leader and the hegemon, but for a very limited number of countries, especially in Europe and some countries in East Asia. But as for the rest of the world, we are really watching the birth of a new international system, of a new era in the development of the international system, with much greater pluralism in every sense, with much greater independence in terms of the foreign policies, and maybe with different sets of institutions.
You know, we've mentioned the end of history here. I'm kind of curious how we got here. Maxime, it's the end of whose history? I think it's the end of the West's narrative about international politics, kind of agreeing with Dmitry, because, you know, there was always this attempt to graft on Russia, to make it part of the history that the West believed in itself. And then this attempt also to do with China, and we've seen, obviously, that it doesn't work. I mean, Russia very forcefully is balked at that, okay? And the Chinese are watching very, very carefully. They're watching how the end of one part of the world's history, and now we have the start of another world's part of history. I think that, you know, we're seeing the end of something and then the beginning of something. Go ahead.
Well, I don't disagree with that. And you know, speaking of China, I think there is a really interesting concept that's gaining traction right now, is what the Chinese are now trying to substitute the concept of the soft power, you know, coined by Joseph Nye in early 1990s, that was, you know, dominating the IR theory for a long while. They're now trying to promote their own concept of the so-called discourse power. So basically, they say, you know, there is doesn't really matter what types of soft power tools you have. What matters is that you set the narrative, that you set up the discourse, and that's what's going to matter right now. And I think we're observing a lot of that over the crisis in Ukraine. You know, there's kind of the battle of narratives, and the one actually, you know, both the United States and Russia are in a way speaking to their own audiences. You know, that's why there is this widespread argument that Russia is quote unquote losing the information war. It is losing the information war in the Western audience. Well, at least, you know, as we see here, but we are doing quite well, according to Americans' own estimates, in the rest of the world. And, you know, Russian narrative gets picked up in India, in China, in other countries. And that, I think, also is quite different from what we've seen over the past few years. And, you know, coupled with this, appears to be further de-dollarization of the global economy, you know, that a lot of people, you know, they're now, you know, the sanctions on the Russian oligarchs, which in my view are doing a lot of favor to the Russian economy, frankly. but a lot of people and tycoons over the world are watching this carefully and thinking, well, maybe we shouldn't be investing all that much in the West, that, you know, even one day our assets will be freezed just like that. So
ask Venezuela what happened to their gold. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's change gears a little bit here. I mean, we're talking about control of discourses and narratives here. But Dmitry, it's very coercive to quote unquote Western values, because to control the discourse or control the narrative, you resort to censorship. I mean, and that's what we have gotten here. I mean, if you do not get on board with the official narrative, You're an enemy. It's not like, oh, he just or she disagrees. No, there's a moral value put on it. You are a traitor. And it's very terrifying because that is in complete juxtaposition to what the Western tradition is all about. So I would say by using these narratives in a very forceful way, that it's a very coercive outcome on the values that you claim to uphold. Go ahead, Dmitry.
Well, I think that we are viewing a combination of factors. On the one hand, of course, the West remains dominant in the global narrative makings. And the Western narrative continues to prevail in the global system. This is why we see such an great informational war against Russia. Actually, information is one of the few elements of power where the Western dominance is still maximum. But on the other hand, I completely agree that the coercive usage of this narrative, actually accusations of the countries that do not want to side with the West and remain either neutral or friendly towards Russia, increases the gap between the West and the rest. One of the most prevailing and dominant tendencies in international relations nowadays is the acceleration of this gap, right? We, on the one hand, of course, the West continues to, the collective West continues to, to come together, to consolidate. And consolidation of the West, consolidation of the prominent allies and powers together with the United States, countries like Germany, Japan, and so on. This is indeed one of the most important elements of international relations nowadays. But on the other hand, the gap between this consolidated West and the majority of international relations becomes huge, right? This includes China, this includes India, Brazil, the overwhelming majority of the African countries, including South Africa, BRICS countries altogether. That includes the overwhelming majority of the countries in the Middle East and Latin America. So the West consolidates, but kind of isolates itself from the prevailing majority in the world. And the more coercive the Western blackmail is, informational narrative, the usage of economic instruments such as sanctions, the wider is the gap. So yes, the West remains immensely important, of course. The West remains the producer of many trends and informational narrative, but the role and place in the world, right, of the West in the world remains narrower.
Seems that consolidation is a pyrrhic victory. All right, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lowell. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, right before the break, Max, you wanted to jump in. I can see you're lifting your finger. Go right ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the lines are actually a little more blurred these days than just, say that the Russia and West and the rest, because inside Russia, there are a lot of people who are sympathizing with Western agenda. And in the West, there are a lot of people who are sympathizing with Russian agenda. You know, I've spoken to a colleague in Donbass over a few days ago, and he remarked something very important that struck me. He said, we're seeing a lot of Russians are saying that they're sorry that they're Russians over what's happening in Ukraine. And this is striking to us because we've been dying for 8 years for the right to be called the Russians. You know, we see this striking difference even, within society. So I think we're seeing a lot of these fractures inside these groups, the West and the rest.
Well, always with these kind of conflicts, there's going to be, even within societies, there's going to be a lot differences, which is at the end of the day healthy, okay, but it's painful as well. Dmitry, Foreign Minister Lavrov gave an RT a very interesting interview a few days ago. And actually, I have to say, I really enjoyed it because he basically has said that Russia's relations with the West have come to an end, or a pause of a freeze, let's put it that way. And it's really up to the West to approach Russia if it wants to have a relationship. To the outside world, that it seems almost absurd. But if you look at the context, and this everything is context, it does make sense. Russia tried to play by the rules, then the rules kept changing. Russia agreed to things, and then agreements changed. And so what's the whole point? We saw this from December of last year all the way up to February 24th. You gentlemen saw all of these prime ministers and presidents and foreign ministers all coming to Moscow, all for naught, because they weren't willing to listen. They weren't willing to negotiate. And that's how we've gotten to where we are now. Go ahead.
Well, Peter, I fully agree with Sergei Lavrov in a sense that the whole paradigm, that the whole body of Russia-West relations, which existed over the last 30 years, is now dead. And we are viewing not just political relations, but all the comprehensive system of links and interactions being just burned down. Which includes economic relations, humanitarian relations, tourism, cultural, educational ties, everything. For me personally, I was born in St. Petersburg, and for me, a very indicative moment was when Finland decided to cancel the brotherhood relations between Turku and St. Petersburg. These brotherhood relations were established in 1953 with the city of Leningrad. And nothing later, including the Prague Spring, Soviet invasion into Afghanistan, nothing prevented the continuation of those brotherhood relations. But today it decided to cancel them all. So all the body of relations is now burned down. And indeed, the very paradigm of Russian interactions with the West is over, which was the paradigm of Russia's of West centrism. In Russian foreign policy, Russia really tried to establish something, common European security system, many other things with the West and with Europe. In 1990s, Russia tried to integrate into the Western system. It failed. After that, Russia has been trying to establish some sort of a deal, some sort of arrangement and agreement on the rules of the game. Between Russia and Europe. It also failed, and ultimately Russia was compelled, to ensure its interests unilaterally with the use of military force. So this previous paradigm when Russia tried to find some modus vivendi, some accommodation with the West is over. We are at a zero point. What comes next actually indeed depends on the West. And the major alternatives are this. Alternative number one, we come from the zero and establish some peaceful coexistence model with very limited amount of interactions, with very limited agenda, but still very important agenda, such as strategic stability, deconfliction, managing arms race, arms control, preservation of some elements of interaction and humanitarian relations, come back to normalcy when it comes to tourism and other elements. This is one alternative, which is, of course, much more preferable. The other alternative is if the West decides to continue the total war against Russia, even beyond the end of the military conflict in Ukraine. If no sanctions are being repealed or at least remitted, if there is still a huge political attempt to contain Russia, to isolate Russia, to destroy the Russian economy, again, beyond the end of the war in Ukraine, then it is another paradigm, right? Then it is the paradigm of the continuation of war through non-lethal means. And then, unfortunately, we would ultimately face further escalation.
But see, if we take the two paradigms, the two options that we just heard, it seems to me there's a continuation from the end of the Cold War to the present. And that ultimately it is forced regime change in Russia. I think it's going to be number two, that we just heard. is that there's good, this is all part of a continuum. And this is war. This is one of the things I think that populations, particularly in the West, they don't understand that word anymore, war. The West is at war with Russia right now. We don't want to use that word because everyone thinks of a nuclear war, but we're up to that point. And this is an economic war, an information war, cutting civil society, everything, okay? I don't see why it's going to, it won't stop. I mean, there has to be, hegemony doesn't appreciate barriers. It will resist and continue. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree. I'll just draw your attention to two important, in my view, things. One is remember the war in Syria and all the massive information pressure campaign on Russia that virtually halted this policy of regime change in the Middle East. Past week, President Assad traveled to the United Arab Emirates for the first time, which, you know, I think is remarkable progress in how Russia sees things in the Middle East in particular, and, you know, in defiance of all the Western policies over the past few years. And the second thing, is anyone still talking about the think of the political interference that has dominated U.S.-Russia relations over the past four years? You know, that the crisis in Ukraine makes it look like it's a totally normal tool of foreign policy, and we remember that a lot of sanctions were slipped on Russia for political interference, you know, and Russia spoke about, you know, America's interference now, and remember like how huge how big of a deal that was, you know, that the Russian political interference, all kind of stuff. Now all of that is thrown under the bus because there are other more important things on.
You're talking about Russia again. Yes.
Exactly. Right. What I'm trying to say with this is there are big things that dominate Russia-West relations, but you know what we're seeing now is really a reality check of all the things, like what's really important, and I think some new type of relations will emerge from that. The key moment to me, whether the West would be willing to come to terms that Russia is quote unquote a peer power competitor, is how much the West will get hurt with these policies and counter sanctions and other things it is doing. Not Russia is doing, the West itself is doing. I can easily imagine how the quote unquote regime change in Russia will happen a lot later than the quote unquote regime change in the United States.
That is such an interesting point, Dmitry. You know, the U.S. and its allies have a very long history of sanctioning countries that basically cannot defend themselves, okay? They can't defend themselves militarily. They can't defend themselves economically. And now we have a G20 country that is fully assaulted. And the fact that it is an important country in the international system in every sense of the word, there's going to be blowback against the West. I mean, you can punch up Panama, and it's not going to change the future of the Western Hemisphere, okay? But when there's a breach like this of this scale, the blowback is almost impossible to determine at this point. I mean, it will ricochet for years. We'll see. Go ahead, jump in.
Well, Peter, I think that this is precisely one of the major factors why a peaceful coexistence model might prevail in Russia-West relations after the end of the hot war in Ukraine, because the continuation of total economic war and attempts to isolate Russia diplomatically will backfire. They have already started to backfire. You know, the West has completely exhausted the potential for those sanctions that do not hurt back, right? The West is now implying the instruments such as trade war, you know, cancellation of Russia's most favored nation status in trade, which destroy the global economic governance, which destroy the WTO, global economy, and destroy the dominance of the US dollar in global finance. So on the one hand, the United States, for instance, clearly supports the continuation of war in Ukraine and prevents a quick political resolution to be achieved. On the other hand, the continuation of war means innumerable number of refugees, which are counted in millions, in hundreds of thousands, which is an enormous pressure on the Western economies. The destruction of the global economy might result into hunger, not just the deficit of food, but pure hunger in many African countries, which are dependent on the imports of wheat and so on and so forth. It means also enormous migration into the West European countries, right? And they need to think about this. So in order to remedy and to manage those challenges, they must come to the new terms of relations with Russia. Of course, the paradigm of relations will continue to be confrontational. But peaceful coexistence in the previous Cold War was also a part and parcel of the Cold War.
We've run out of time, gentlemen, but I always tell Western policymakers, be careful what you wish for. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I thank my guests here in Moscow. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.